Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
Gentlemen,
we are tonight's entertainment.
30 years from now, the mob will control time travel. My job is to eliminate targets sent here from the future. Even if the target is me.
September 28th, you let him run free.
I'm gonna fix this! I'm gonna fight it!
You can't escape.
I'm gonna take everything you got!
Your future.
This is my life now. You had yours already, so why don't you do what old men do and die?
Looper.
Good evening, everybody. It's Sunday night. Welcome to Punch Drunk Critics Live. That was, of course, the TV spot trailer for Looper, the one that I'm going to go ahead and guess that we're most excited to talk about this evening, but there are a couple other good movies that that we have to talk about tonight. There's a whole bunch of movies out this weekend. I don't think we're going to get to them all. But we're going to get to at least Pitch Perfect, Perks of Being a Wallflower, Looper, and I know Travis is just dying to talk about Hotel Transylvania, so we'll let him talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah,
what's going on, bud?
Not much, man. I'm actually really tired right now. We just drove back from Pittsburgh, so I'm a little tired. But no, there are a lot of movies that came out this week. Maybe about half of those are good. Maybe three of those are good. Two of them were shit. But three of them are pretty good, and we'll definitely talk about those three. I think I've done enough bashing of Won't Back Down this week. I don't need to talk about that anymore. And Hotel Transylvania, I don't even think it's really worth discussing. It's just one of those movies that's kind of a throwaway movie. But Won't Back Down made me actively angry. So
really?
I don't really want to talk about it all that much anymore. Yeah.
Which, just to clarify for anybody out there that was thinking like I was thinking, it is not the Kevin James MMA movie, Won't Back Down. It's a Maggie Gyllenhaal teacher movie. So let's just put that out there in the first place. What do you want to start with today? We do have Stephen Chbosky joining us on air to talk about Perks of Being a Wallflower. He wrote and directed the movie and wrote the novel before it.
So
got a little insight as to the story of behind everything.
I think it's only fair that we talk about the Perks of Being a Wallflower first, and then we go into the Chbosky interview, because I think it's a really good interview. He has a lot to say about, obviously, his own source material, and this being his directorial debut. So he had a lot to say about all that. And there were a lot of the Perks of Being a Wallflower could have been just another teenage, coming-of-age story full of angst and broken hearts and all that kind of stuff. You know, we've seen that movie before, and I certainly felt like I had seen this movie before I actually did see it. But when I actually went to see it, it turned out to be something much greater than I expected. But overall, the movie stars Logan Lerman, who mostly recognized from Percy Jackson, those movies, and Three Musketeers. He plays Charlie, who's a boy who's just entering high school. He's got a ton of personal problems. He just suffered a recent death of his best friend. He's got some other issues going on at home as well. And basically, he's just sort of an introvert. He's not the kind of guy who goes out and makes friends very easily, and all his personal tragedies only make it even harder. Well, he gets to high school, and of course, he becomes a target of bullies and things like that fairly easily. But he makes friends with Sam, played by Emma Watson, and Patrick, played by Ezra Miller, from We Need to Talk About Kevin. And they invite him into their little clique, which Sam affectionately refers to as their little island of misfit toys. They're basically just the outcasts of the outcasts. And then in that environment, Charlie begins to sprout his wings a little bit and experience all the things normal teenagers experience. Sex, his first relationship, drugs, all that stuff that we're all very familiar with. And that's basically the gist of it. The story is about how Charlie kind of comes out of his shadow a little bit and stops being a wallflower, so to speak. But I'll tell you, I really, really love this movie. And the reason why, the main reason why I love it, is because I feel like a lot of movies like this really treat teenage problems kind of offhandedly, like they're not that important. And,
right.
And which is funny because most of these movies are made by adults who experience this stuff firsthand, and it's kind of like they forget what it was like. But
yeah.
This movie really takes it seriously, and it makes everything seem as important to a teenager as our adult problems seem to us. And I think that's a big difference and one of the reasons why this movie is so great.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two things that set this movie apart from other, you know, like you said, this is a plot that can easily fall into the plot of 30 other lesser movies. I think the main difference that sets this apart is, number one, that, like you were saying, they do – you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. They do kind of give benefit to the problems of teenagers being real to them. And I think – you know, I can almost understand why that gets messed up so much because, you know, hindsight's 20/20. You know, you look back at your high school years and you're like, wow, that's so stupid. Why was I upset about that? But then you didn't know that was stupid. You know, it's a real problem, and you know, your reality is what you're perceiving. So,
right.
You know, I like that they gave credence to that. And Charlie is not the kind of guy that you usually see in these movies. I thought he was more of a He was less. It was less of like a caricature of what one of these people would be like, and more of just a guy that you could kind of get behind a little bit. And he's not super sulky. He's not writing poems in his room playing World of Warcraft. And he's not going to all the obvious points to show that he's a loner.
They scaled that back a little bit. They scaled that back a little bit because in the book he's a lot whinier. In the book he cries a lot. And the book is written epistolary style. So he's basically, the entire novel is him writing to an imaginary friend or in a friend that we never really meet.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the book plays out. They're really kind of toned that down in the movie. So you don't really see that. They kind of replace it with some voiceover, some narration that they use every now and then. But they really play down those aspects of it, and I think it works better that way. I think we talked about that a little bit in the interview about how Charlie's different in the movie than he is in the book. But I think that was a smart move to do that because Charlie could have very easily been an unlikable character.
Oh yeah,
the kind of character that you don't really care enough. You feel like he's so down on himself that you don't even feel like he's worth rooting for. But he never reaches that point. And
I
think a lot of that.
Even when they're not that bad, when they're like Ethan Embry and Can't Hardly Wait, I mean, in that movie he was fine, but that was, you know, the first time we really saw that particular character. But I think Charlie's less of the normal lead character. Maybe in the book he was more of what you'd expect the lead character to be in a movie like this, but he just really seemed – it made it seem more real that he was more like a real person than like a caricature of somebody that would be unpopular.
How good is Emma Watson in this movie? I mean, I already love her anyway for any number of reasons. I think she might be my number one right now. I really love her right now. But she is. Yeah, go ahead.
She's the Han Solo. She's the Harrison
Ford.
Awesome. Whenever you have
awesome
a hugely
right
popular franchise, generally there's one person that's going to make it out of that franchise. That's where I get the Harrison Ford from because he was the only one that really made a career afterwards.
Fisher made a career. So did Billy Dee. They had careers.
Mark
Hamill
really
didn't.
To step apart from the he's one of the greatest comic voice actors in the business with Joker. But no, I mean, to step up to not just continue with work, but to really step into the next level after that franchise has ended. And I think she's going to be the one that does it.
I think she's the one who's going to do it too. I think Daniel Radcliffe is doing a good job as well. But but she's by far is the one who's breaking out on her own. And in this movie, to me, I mean, she's just such a commanding presence in this film.
Mm-hmm.
She's just gorgeous, luminous. She just takes over everything, and you can see why Charlie so easily falls in love with her. I mean, and I'm not giving away anything by saying that. A lot of this movie is about his dealing with those first feelings of love. So, I mean, that's not a big deal. But you can see why. And you can see, I love the way her character is. She's kind of a woman coming into her own, and she's she's dealing with she's starting to you know, notice adult responsibilities and things like that, and she's got some tough decisions to make. And, you know, and I love that part of her. She's a little bit anxious about some of those responsibilities, too. I love that aspect of her. But you also can see why so many people rally around her, why she's sort of the ringleader of that whole group.
Oh, no doubt.
I mean, she's amazing.
She just kind of oozes confidence in what she is, even if under the surface it might be a little bit different. You know, she's able to ooze that kind. And, you know, Emma Watson is – got something that not many people have, and that's the ability to be the girl next door but still be more beautiful than everybody else around. Like, you know, a lot of times if you were to put, like, a Kate Beckinsale as a girl next door, you'd be like, well, no, that's not believable. But Emma Watson's got that look that you could believe it. Like, she's got a normal look to her, but it's a ridiculously gorgeous normal look.
Yeah. I can't wait to see her in that Jay and Seth versus the Apocalypse movie with
those
people in. I can't wait to see her in that movie.
I have a feeling she's going to be really good at comedy. I just have weird feeling about that.
I agree. I think so, too. But overall, I thought this movie was great. I gave it a 4 out of 5. I think it's one of the best teenage high school movies that I've seen in a very long time. One of the best I've seen maybe ever. I thought it was really great.
Yeah, it gets a 4 out of 5 for me as well. I was actually really, really surprised going into this. I knew I was going to like Emma Watson in it, but I didn't know how I was going to. I just got the feeling it was going to be like a hipster type, you know, movie where, oh, we're counterculture, so we're, you know, we're cool or whatever. And it really didn't play off like that. It played off more about, you know, human emotions and not one particular sect of anything. And really surprised me with that. It's really fun watching, and it's not like a throwaway teen drama like 99% of them are. So gets 4 out of 5 for me.
All right. So like you said, I did have a chance to sit down and talk with Steven Chbosky, who wrote the book that this is based on and also makes his directorial and writing debut with this film. So let's go ahead and listen to that interview that I had with Steven. And it's about 20 minutes long, so it's a good little piece here, but it's very interesting. So let's check that out now.
Check this out. We'll be back.
You wrote Perks back in 1999, right?
I wrote it. I actually wrote it in 96, but yeah, I published it in 99.
Okay. What was the inspiration for the story? Was it taken from some of your own experiences?
It was a combination of my own experience, stories I've heard over the years, and also a central question about why good people let themselves get treated badly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time when I wrote the book, I had come through a bad breakup, and I needed some hope, you know, like we all do at times like that. And Charlie, the main character, Charlie, and his voice gave me the hope that I needed.
Where did the title from the movie come from? Because it's a very interesting title.
The title, when I was in college, I mean, this is a long time ago. When I was in college, years before I wrote the book, I was trying to write something else. And the kid was talking in that story, and he just said, I guess it's one of the perks of being a wallflower. And I stopped in that moment, and I knew I had a title. That character I was creating then did not work. That incarnation didn't happen, but I kept turning those words over in my head. And then a few years later, I sat down and wrote the book.
That's awesome. So would you say that that Charlie is sort of a reflection of you in some ways, how you felt in high school?
Yeah, Charlie's just how I feel in life. He's very, very personal to me. And although we're not the same, by any stretch, he's kind of my purest self. You know? He's the one that really wants people to be happy and, you know, and doesn't yell at people when they cut them off on the freeway. You know, he's a good soul. Yeah.
So I guess in some ways, I think that's one of the things that would make him slightly different than, like, a Holden Caulfield type character. I feel like Holden's a little bit more angry than Charlie is. But obviously Catcher in the Rye is a big influence on the book, you know. But would you say that those are the only differences between the two? It's like their sort of their temperament.
Oh, there's several differences. It really is. Look, they're both coming of age books. They're both first-person narrators. Mm-hmm. They are about high school, but the books are as different as Holden and Charlie are.
Mm-hmm.
I love Catching the Rye. It's one of my favorite books growing up, And there are many influences on my book. That would be one of them.
Right.
But yeah, there's no, because the worldviews of the two characters are so completely different than the books are as different.
It always seems like anytime there's a coming of age story with a male central figure, that Catcher in the Rye is always the first thing it's compared to.
Yes.
But I think a lot of that has to do, and this is just my personal opinion I'm throwing out there, we don't really get a lot of these kinds of stories anymore. Like, we used to get a lot of them back in the day, you know, whether it was in books or movies. We got a lot of coming-of-stage stories with male central figures, but it seems like lately we don't get as many of those anymore. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, yes. It's a very proud tradition, and I don't know why it dried up as much as it did. I think that's one of the things that made my book stand out in the last 10 years, is the fact that there aren't a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not sure why. I can say, in terms of the book and also my movie, I can speak to my movie in terms of some of the other influences if you'd like, because, you know, there's also a proud tradition in movies, and they haven't done it as much lately either. There's, you know, I think back to Rebel Without a Cause or The Graduate.
Right.
Or Harold and Maude, and even some of the more ensemble stories like Stand By Me or Dead Poets Society or even The Breakfast Club.
Mm-hmm.
And they're such a part of growing up for so many people. I didn't understand why Hollywood doesn't try to attempt them more, and why they go with some more of just the broad comedies or just horror. Or, you know, I mean, I love a lot of those movies, but I wanted to do a movie that was in the tradition of some of those greats.
Do you think it has anything to do with, I mean, I guess if you look at coming-of-age stories now, most of them are very female-driven. Mm-hmm. Most of them are, or they're heavily steeped in fantasy, like Twilight or something like that. Do you think it's because, is it possible that girls have more of a, you know, they have more of a tendency to purchase stuff like this? Or are they just kind of, you know, there's a bigger audience for that sort of thing?
Oh, I think it's manyfold. The reason why you have more female-driven stories, I think, came out of the women's movement, and this is just a natural evolution of that. You know,
mm-hmm.
where there are more women writers, there are more women directors and executives in Hollywood, things like that. And with that also came the audience. You know,
mm-hmm.
there was a time when I think Judy Blume was the only thing that talked about what girls went through. And now there are dozens, and I think the stories are great. Especially, you know, near and dear to my heart, especially the movie Juno, because my producers, Leanne Russ and John Malkovich, they produced Juno, and you know, they brought a lot of that with them.
Right. No, Juno is a great film. I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah.
So we don't get to see. It's not that often that we see authors adapting and directing their own work. So I'd like to hear about the sort of the process you went through in adapting your own novel for the big screen. How did that work out for you?
Sure. Well, the process, first of all, I needed time and distance away because the book's so personal to me. And in order to do a proper adaptation, I needed some distance.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate effect of that distance is I was older. And so to do an authentic movie about that age, I had to do some work and remember what it was like to have that first kiss and that first crush and those
right.
parties and that school dance. We all have those memories. I can say just the words first kiss, and I imagine all of your listeners instantly think back to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something very special and very magical in the further you get away from that in your life, sometimes the harder it is to I guess see kids on eye level, like what they're really going through, and remember what they're really going through. So for me, I did that work, and once I did that, once I was in the emotional state to be able to do the work, I figured out that movies are so different than books, especially when you have a first-person book in that, you know, Charlie in the book can say, oh, Patrick's really funny, or say that Sam is so beautiful and nice. And because he's a reliable narrator, we just go with it, and we accept these people as he accepts these people.
Right.
And so, but then in a movie, guess what? You have to make Patrick really funny. You know, you actually have to earn it. And you have to find ways to make the audience feel about Patrick and Sam in these situations the way that they relied on Charlie to narrate their feelings. And that, it was a big challenge, but it was also a big reward when I was able to figure out how to do it. You know, and especially with that cast. And they really brought it home for all of us.
So what were some of the compromises that you felt you had to make in making the translation here? Like, Charlie's a very different character in the book than he is in the movie, I think.
That's interesting.
I think in some ways. I think he's a little bit more prone to crying in the book than he is in the movie and stuff like that.
It's interesting that you say that about the crying, because anyone that knows the book, it's like part of this thing in the book. But in the movie, what I felt was that it was just, it's the nature of movies versus books. Like a book, the reader is in charge, and if they want to put it down, or it's a little close to home, or they need a little break, they can just, you know. And at home, I guess you can hit pause. But movies, especially in a movie theater, you know, the filmmakers are in charge, and you have to respect that people have certain limits. God knows me as an audience, looking at my own movie had limits, and so you have to find ways to get to the same catharsis using that medium.
Right.
Does that answer your question, or I want to make sure that I...
No, it was a great answer. It was a fine answer. So did you always have plans of directing it, or did you possibly have somebody else in mind at first?
Never. I was never going to sell it. I mean, my agent told me that the book has had offers like every week since it was published almost.
Wow.
And from different people, and you know, a German film company, believe it or not, wanted to buy it and make it a German coming of age story. Which in an alternative universe, I actually would have loved to have seen that one.
I would too. That'd be very interesting.
Yeah, that would have been really interesting.
Their spin on it would have been.
Yeah, it would have been different. But for me, I'm right now living my lifelong dream. When I thought of that title 21 years ago, and when I wrote the book, I always knew it was going to be a movie. I always knew that this was going to happen, and I just needed to get myself ready to do it right and to do it. Do it proud for the fans of the book. And so no, never. I was either going to direct this movie, or it was never going to exist.
Right. Did you run into any, like, did the studios ever give you any trouble with that? Did they ever try to convince you to bring in a bigger name to direct it possibly?
No, not at all.
No, no issues?
No, because when I went to the studios, you have to remember, I'd already written the screenplay, and I'd already gotten my producers, you know, Leanne Halfin, Russ Smith, and John Malkovich. And we as a team, we got Emma Watson, and then Logan Lerman auditioned, and he was so great as Charlie. He was the second person to audition for it, and I didn't audition anyone after him because I didn't need to. That's where we went in. That was the package that we did, because I knew, much like your question, that if I went in too early, that people might question my ability to do this job.
Right.
And it was too important to me to take that risk.
How had your previous experiences making, you know, movies and TV, how did that inform your style in directing this film?
Well, it made all the difference. You know, I started my career, I directed this little low budget movie with my friends. I was 23 years old, and you know, it was great because we went to Sundance and everything, but I was so green. And between that movie and 15 years later directing Perks, I had done, you know, I'd done Rent, the screenplay for Rent. And with Rent, I worked with, worked under Spike Lee for a summer. And although that version did not happen, I learned so much from Spike. And then Chris Columbus came on board, and I learned so much just watching Chris on set, because he's very friendly to writers. He says, you know, come on board, you know, soak up as much as you want. He was great. I also worked with directors in movies that didn't get made, and which is more of what happens in Hollywood usually. But, you know, that's, I met Griffin Dunne and Jay Roach, who did, you know, Meet the Parents and the Austin Powers movies. And I learned a lot from Jay. And then finally Jericho, which was the show that I co-created and I wrote the pilot for, John Turteltaub, who did National Treasure, he directed the pilot in the second episode, which I also did. And we had so many different directors coming through the door. What I realize, what I tell any film student or any young aspiring filmmaker that asks me, you know, asks me for advice, I just say, you have no idea how many different styles people have. And once I knew that there wasn't a, quote, right way to do it, I just concentrated on how I wanted to do it. But, you know, by creating a good atmosphere on set and by casting people as much as casting actors. And it just set me free. And I had the greatest time just, you know, learning from these you know, really terrific directors and putting it all in my own style.
Speaking of Jericho, do you still have any of those peanuts that all those people sent in?
No, if I did, they wouldn't be terribly, shall we say, fresh.
No, they wouldn't.
But no, I have to say, you know, for all of us involved in Jericho, it was when that happened, we knew some people liked the show. We had no idea that we had that kind of a fan base, and that was really gratifying. Even though we only got 7 more episodes, I'll always remember that spring, the Nuts campaign and the 20 tons of nuts they sent to CBS. So,
it must be gratifying.
I just want to say thank you to anyone out there listening who possibly sent a peanut to CBS on Jericho's behalf.
It must be gratifying that people seem to relate so much to your work in general, whether it was Jericho or it's this book and what I think will be this movie. It must be extremely gratifying to know that people relate to you in such a way, relate to your work.
It is gratifying. You know, one of the happy accidents, you call it, is, you know, when I wrote the book for personal reasons, as I said, but you publish it partly because you hope that, you know, the book or, you know, whether it's whatever contribution I made to Rent, screenwriter, or Jarek, you want people to not feel alone in these thoughts, and especially with the person being a wallflower, I wanted kids out there who might feel that no one understands to know that people understand. Mm-hmm. And then when you get, over the years, I've gotten so many letters and so many messages, and I've met, you know, people at signings and readings or whatnot, and when every person comes up to you and says that that your work made them not feel alone, the happy accident is the fact that I'm the one that doesn't feel alone and over and over again, because these thoughts, I have them, and I'm so moved and humbled that all these people share them. You know, it's a much bigger and friendlier and accepting world than I thought it was. And it's all because of those fans.
Do you think something like that, having people that have such a close relationship with your work, do you think that makes future projects harder or difficult? Like, do you feel like you need to sort of appease those people more now, or do you continue to just kind of do your own thing?
I see what you're saying. Well, no, I don't feel the need to appease people at all. But Jericho is so monumentally different than the first being a wallflower.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with each thing you do, you're just going to attract, you know, different fans, or maybe, you know, hopefully some of them will go on their journey with you. But no, I don't feel that, because then it would be inauthentic. I'm trying to write, I'm trying to write my stories, and it would be disingenuous to try to write other people's stories.
Right.
You know, that's for them, and I hope that they continue to like what I'm doing. But yeah, you can't appease, because pretty soon if you do that, then you're pandering, and then you know, it just stops being authentic.
Right.
And maybe you feel that way. Like, obviously, you're in your show, you're trying to, you know, you're just following things that interest you.
Right.
And yet you want to listen to people, but it's not. You can't second guess yourself.
Exactly. No, I totally agree with you on that, man. All right, talk to me about casting Emma Watson for the role of Sam. I feel like Sam is such an interesting character and a very complex character to nail down.
Yes.
Tell me what you think Emma brought to the table in this role.
Yeah, what Emma brought to the table, aside from the fact that she's, with everything she does, getting better and better and better as a young actor, she just brought her personality and she brought her passion. You have to understand, you know, Emma is ultimately what got Perks made. And not just her involvement. I'm talking more than that. I mean, she, you know, we weren't getting the financing. We weren't getting the studio backing. And she came to Hollywood from London. She was at Oxford, I believe, at the time. You know, I'm not sure, but she came in from London, I know. And had meeting after meeting after meeting. And she'd been offered so many movies, and she turned them all down. And she said to all the studios, make the person being a wallflower. Mm-hmm. And finally, thank God, someone said yes. And so she brought all of that. And just like Sam in the movie, being the one that take Charlie along, or who's, you know, almost like the den mother of the Island of Misfit Toys, that she took on our cause. And she, you know, what's interesting about her is that she's such a force of nature that way, and she's strong, and she's vivacious, and but she's also incredibly vulnerable. She's very down to earth, and I don't know, maybe it's a British thing, but that when I first met her in New York, I couldn't believe that anyone that grew up in the eye of that hurricane could be that down to earth and grounded. And I just think that she, as an artist and she as a person, feels that they have a lot to prove, not to us, not to the world, but to herself. You know, she's an extraordinary person. You know. And I'm really proud. I'm proud that, you know, you make movies or you do things, and you never know who's going to become your real friend when it's all over. And I'm really happy and proud that she's my friend.
That's awesome. You hope to work with her again on a future project?
Oh, over and over and over again. Yeah, she's a bit of an artistic soulmate, that one. You know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, it's fine. Please go ahead.
No, and she's a bit of an artistic soulmate, and she, you know, she kind of became my little sister, you know, and sometimes she calls me for advice, and it's very sweet, you know. She asks me what things to do, and every now and then I think how surreal it is, because I didn't know. I met her 2 years ago, like this month, you know, and it's one of a wonderful journey how life can give you new friends, and every now and then I think, wow, Emma Watson is calling me for advice. It's very interesting. So, yeah.
It must be very cool having her on your speed dial or something.
It is. It really is.
Would you ever consider, or have you ever given thought to what happens to these characters later on? Like, if you were to follow Sam or follow Charlie, you know, you're giving thought to what happens to these characters in the future.
You know, it's a really interesting question. I say, before I did the movie, I didn't think about it all that much, and since making the movie, and I just fell in love with making this movie, I think about it a lot more, especially the character of Sam and her romance with Charlie. I think about, you know, did they get married or did they not get married, or, you know, did she marry somebody else and they danced at her wedding and they deep down knew that they always belonged together. Like, what is that story? And a lot of that's because I just, you know, I love just as people, Emma, Logan, and Ezra, who play Patrick. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know if there's ever going to be a sequel to the movie or not, or the book. I certainly would never do it for commercial purposes, but I know, I love this cast so much, and I'm so proud of what we were able to do together. It would be a really tempting, fun thing to get the band back together.
All right. The film's going to be showing in Toronto in just a few days. Are you excited?
Oh, yes. another dream come true. I'm really excited to Toronto, not only because it's a film festival and we have a prestigious slot and people are very excited about the movie, but they also have this candy bar called Coffee Crisp. That is just about the best, and you can't get it here. And it's the best candy bar. Yes, it's a I had some Canadian friends. I used to spend some time up there, so it'll be fun to go back.
Oh well, see, now I want to try it. So if you get one, send me one.
That'd be good. I was just given the thumbs up. I think we need to wrap up.
That was the last question for me anyway.
But, that was the last question.
Oh yeah. Okay. That was the last question. But Stephen, it was great talking to you. It was a lot of fun. And
I really enjoyed it. If you ever need a follow up, if you ever need anything, let me know, because look, the one thing about phone is I can do phone anywhere. You know, so if you need anything, you let me know.
Tell Liz that. Tell Liz over there next to you that you said that, because I may just take you up on that. So
okay. Well, yeah, Liz is standing right there. She heard me say it. So.
All right, cool.
Did you? Or were you watching the script? Okay, yeah. So yeah, because I really enjoyed talking to you.
I appreciate that, Steven. It was a lot of fun, and I love the movie. Looking forward to seeing how other people react to it. So thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks, Trev. Okay, man. Well, have a good one. Okay.
All right, you too. All right, and
what
that was
an
interview.
Man.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was one of my favorite interviews that I've done. So he's obviously, as you heard, he's a great interview, great talker, and has a lot to say about the material and what kind of his expectations for it. So I had a lot of fun with that one.
If I may toot our own horn, I always like listening to interviews where it's like a conversation, like it's just two people kicking back and talking about a movie and not. Talk about this, point A. Talk about this, point B. And they're just a lot nicer to listen to. But some good insight on the movie there, a movie that we both liked. And I think that might be close to our highest join scores of the year so far. I'm sure we had a couple other both got fours. But so definitely something you should check out is Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Definitely.
Now, with about an hour left in the show, we still have tons of movies to talk about. What do you want? You want to go time travel? You want to?
Let's jump back in time with Looper.
All right.
Yeah.
So Looper, as Rian Johnson, as somebody that this site has adored since he first came out with his movie Brick, directed and wrote this time travel epic about a guy who's basically. In the future, there is time travel. It's outlawed, basically because of tracking, like body tracking, things like that. There's no way to get rid of bodies, which poses a problem for the mob. So their solution is to basically send the person they want killed back in time where they can kill them and get rid of them. And this movie is so much more than the trailers make it out to be, which I thought was amazing. This is what I love about Rian Johnson. He can have a gimmick that could survive on its own, really. I mean, mm-hmm. What would you do if you were an assassin like that and they sent you back to kill yourself, basically? How would you react? And it could have. That's almost what I thought the movie was going to be, but it's so much deeper than that. There's so many other storylines going in. Basically, they send him back.
And we can't. We really shouldn't spoil any of them either.
Before we
get too deep into it, let's not spoil any of the things that you won't find in the TV spots or trailers, because like you said, there's a lot to this movie. There's a lot more to it. I think it pulls from a number of different elements and genres to make something that I feel is totally unique. Yeah, I can say that some of the early action is reminiscent of Blade Runner in a sense. I can say that it gets a little reflective and slower paced in the second half of the movie, but it's never boring. I mean, there's a lot going on in this movie that really should not be spoiled. So let's say that before we get too thick into the weeds here.
Okay, well, if that's the case, then we'll just close it there with the synopsis before I trample over anything. But, I mean, Rian Johnson is a guy, and this is going to be a love fest for Rian Johnson, sorry, in advance. But, in The Brothers Bloom, that was a movie that, by all indications, could have been very boring to watch, but his writing style, the way he shoots things, like the visual clues that he puts into his movies, make it so much more interesting, even just looking at nothing. And I was kind of concerned going into Looper that maybe he was transitioning to action and he'd drop off the things in the past. But it's like he's one of the only people I've seen come up in the movie business that instead of dropping things and going more mainstream, he just keeps building onto this tower of filmmaking he makes and puts the same kind of things in every movie. I mean, the visual kind of tricks aren't as heavy in this as they were in Brothers Bloom or even Brick, but they are there. The inventive style of shooting and just the depth of story that he brings to it. I mean, if you haven't seen Brick, we told you 100 times to see it on the show. Go see Brick. It's on Netflix Instant right now. Check it out. But, I mean, it gives you a good idea of how in-depth this story goes. And for anybody that's ever contemplated the Terminator time travel timeline, we know that it can get quite complicated. But I think he did a good job of keeping everything kind of on a straight line.
I think the best thing about this movie, maybe not the best thing, because I think there are a lot of great things about it. But one thing that Johnson does that's really smart is he doesn't make the time travel stuff too complicated. And in fact, he kind of makes fun of it a little bit. He has his characters, I don't want to start talking about time travel. We'll be sitting here on the table making diagrams of straws or something like that. You know, he kind of makes fun of the time travel thing. And he doesn't, while he doesn't outright ignore it, he just doesn't get to, he doesn't let it run the movie, mm-hmm. which is really what happens with a lot of these time travel movies. The time travel aspect just totally takes over, and you spend your whole time trying to figure out the mechanics of it. But this movie doesn't do that, and I think that's one of the best things. It, just like all his other movies, it's rooted in character first, and there's always this sort of morality play that's in the center of every one of his stories. Brick was that way. The Brothers Bloom was that way. And this movie's that way. There are some complicated decisions that had to be made for the central character. And our perceptions of the central character change a lot during the movie. And that happens in Brick, and it happens in The Brothers Bloom also. Our opinions of these characters can change with a single sentence. You know, it's like, okay, I'm rooting for this guy 1 minute, and the next minute, I'm rooting for him to fail. You know, it's one of these things that just, it kind of ping-pongs back and forth, and it's really interesting to watch. Like I said, it's not all-out action, but there's so many things going on with these people that it's never dull, not for a moment.
Yeah, no, it's a good mix of everything, and that's kind of what I meant by he's keeping his who he is as well as going more mainstream at the same time, moral ambiguity is not the right word to describe. It's the only one I can think of right now, though, that all his characters, central characters at least, seem to have, that they give you that ability to turn on a dime about what you think about them, and I think that's the exact right
phrase to use for it.
I think that's one of the best facets of his storytelling is having that as a main part of most of what he tells, because while it's easy to watch a movie like Transformers where the good guys are talk like good guys and the bad guys talk like bad guys and everything like that, it's much more interesting and much more refreshing to see something where if people are people, every single one of us is that way kind of. So he's great on all fronts, and I'm really glad to see. I mean, as we know from like Kevin Smith and other good storytellers, that translating over into a more dynamic style of shooting and having more going on doesn't always work out. But I think that he did just fine with everything he's got going on.
Yeah, I love this movie a lot, and it's interesting to me because our natural inclination is always to root for Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you always want to root for Bruce Willis, but there are even times in this movie where you might not want to. Mm-hmm. You know, he does some pretty heinous things in this movie. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's by no means a hero in this movie. And, you know, I honestly, and I'm not going to give away anything about the Emily Blunt character, because I think hers, more so than any other, is crucial to the spoilery aspect of this plot.
Mm-hmm.
But even her character, you know, it's sort of unclear where she stands in a lot of it as well. So, I mean, it's just, there's so much going on in this movie, and that's what makes it so much fun. But I want to talk about Joseph Gordon-Levitt's performance here, because he has a really difficult performance. I think Bruce Willis is sort of playing Bruce Willis in a lot of ways. He's a tough guy. He has some gallows humor and things like that. That's just kind of who he is. He's just kind of playing himself in a sense.
Right.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's got all these prosthetics on his face to make himself look like Bruce Willis. To me, he doesn't really look like Bruce Willis at all, even with it. But
he could be a cousin. It's reminiscent, I'd say.
But the thing that got me were his mannerisms. He acts like Bruce Willis. He moves like Bruce Willis. And it sometimes even sounds like Bruce Willis. I mean, just the way he talks, and sometimes Bruce Willis could start like this and get a little quiet, you know. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt had it perfect. That's what got me about it. He didn't really need the prosthetics. Like, we see people who don't look like each other all the time playing variations on the same character. We see that all the time. So we didn't need the prosthetics. Joseph Gordon-Levitt can act like Bruce Willis. And that's the part that really struck me, was how good he was at that. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that is probably one of the hardest things. Because when you're imitating somebody, people always just go right towards the obvious cues. Especially Stallone, you'd be talking like this all the time, doing the real deep voice. But in order to make it convincing, it has to be the subconscious things, the underlying things. And that's, That's got to be. I mean, we're talking watching tape after tape of somebody and programming that into your memory to override what you're used to doing. And you're right. I think the prosthetics. I was a little bit more friendly to him just because I thought they were going to be horrible. We all did when the pictures first came out. But it actually did give a little bit more of the feel to it. But he was Bruce Willis. I mean, just by looking at them, they could have been related by some point. But as soon as they're moving and walking, especially in the scenes they're together, right. they are. It's convincing that they're the same person.
Yeah, they have some really funny moments together. And Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt together on screen are hilarious, especially when you really think about it, how it's one guy kicking his own ass, yeah. then that's kind of funny too. So there's a lot of little bits of humor in this movie as well, but like we said, it's mostly a morality play. It's a character study more than anything else, but it has its share of action. The movie is never dull. I really love this movie a lot. I gave it a 4.5 out of 5. I think it's Rian Johnson really taking genre to a new level, the way he did with Brick, the way he did with The Brothers Bloom, and now he's doing it for science fiction. The guy can do no wrong. As far as I'm concerned, the next thing for him to do is make a romantic comedy. and he'll probably bring Joseph Gordon-Levitt back for that also.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see his take on horror, but romantic comedy would probably be good too, just because he's such a good storyteller. But yeah, this gets a 4 out of 5 for me. It's as much as I was getting loopered out with all the press for it and all the trailers on every single screen, yeah, every single time I turned TV on, by the time I sat down in the theater and started watching it, you know, it's good enough that it just took a hold of you, and it's a really, really good 2 hours of movie watching, and a lot more simple than most of the ones like it, and it gets to the point and it's still deep. It's damn near perfect as far as sci-fi movies go.
If I have one complaint, and it's a minor one, and it's kind of something that affects all of Rian Johnson's movies, I always feel like once he gets towards the end, he has a lot of shuffling around of characters to get to the finale. Mm-hmm. I feel like he had to do that with The Brothers Bloom. He did it a lot. He had a lot of shuffling around of characters to do in order to make that finale make sense. And I feel like he kind of has to do that here. The last 20 minutes, there's a lot of scrambling to get things into place. But other than that, I mean, that felt a little clunky to me. But other than that, I don't have a lot of complaints with it. So like I said, 4.5 out of 5, I really enjoy this one.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think Johnson's the kind of guy that left to his own devices would make a 4-hour movie to flesh out all those things completely. But that's just not the way Hollywood goes. So, but yeah, I mean, that's nothing to distract you from it. I say it's the theater pick of the week.
I would agree with that, actually.
So.
But another film that people might want to check out this weekend, I think, is Pitch Perfect.
Indeed.
Let's talk about that for a minute. Pitch Perfect stars Anna Kendrick, who I think is a favorite of both of ours right
indeed.
Now. Indeed. This movie has so much to look at, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Pitch Perfect stars Anna Kendrick as Becca, who's a kind of rebellious college student. At Barden University, and she has a dream of being a radio DJ where she can make mashup tapes and play them all on the air and all that stuff. That's what she likes to do. She wants to be a producer in a sense. She joins this a cappella group called the Barden Bellas, led by the lovely Anna Camp and the even more lovely Brittany Snow with red hair, I might add. And they proceed to go against the Troublemakers, which is the all-boy band of the group, who are kind of assholes, really. And what you get, basically, is what I call Glee meets Bring It On. That's really what the movie is. Within 5 minutes, I was whispering to, I think it was our friend Sandy Chin, it might have been somebody else. I said, oh, this is just Bring It On, okay. And there are some aspects of it that are dead on, like Bring It On was, including the... Mm-hmm. The audition phase where girls are trying out to join the Barden Bellas, it's almost pulled exactly out of Bring It On. But I think the most, and I came up with, and I think it probably a more accurate description is Best in Show meets Bring It On. I wrote this in my review that the movie had a lot of aspects that were taken straight from Christopher Guest's movies, like A Mighty Wind and, like you said, Best in Show and For Your Consideration, because it's a movie that I think is reverential of the a cappella movement, and it is sort of a movement right now, folks, in colleges. It's sort of reverential of it, but it also skewers the shit out of it. And we see a lot of that, especially in the, during the concert sequences with Elizabeth Banks and John Michael Higgins as the commentators. Mm-hmm. You know, they clearly they're fans, but clearly also they realize how silly the whole thing is.
Yeah.
That's sort of this movie in a nutshell. It's kind of reverential. It kind of loves it and kind of hates a cappella. But overall, I thought it was a whole lot of fun. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's one of the things that got me over the hump with this movie is the fact that it does poke at itself. There's nothing worse than a movie that takes something completely ridiculous seriously and then completely takes it seriously the whole time. I get it. If you're in one of these a cappella groups, it is serious. It's what you do. It's your life. But, you know, watching it from the outside, it just seems kind of silly sometimes. And I always – as much leeway as I give to action movies for being completely formulaic and stupid, for lack of a better term, I don't give the same respect to dance movies or singing movies of the same sort. But whether it be from the cast or from the slight differences and things like laughing at itself a bit, I actually did like this movie quite a bit. Rebel Wilson is probably one of my new favorites. She's the one who's highlighted in the trailers, Fat Amy.
They're highlighting her more than Anna Kendrick right now.
Yeah,
which I think is interesting. Rebel Wilson, most will remember her from Bridesmaids as Kristen Wiig's roommate, the one who poured the peas on herself. Rebel Wilson is hilarious, and she's a scene stealer in this movie. I love her.
Oh yeah,
I'm a little fearful of this new TV show she's gonna have, but I'll watch her in almost anything right now.
Yeah, she is a perfect. I'm not going to say she's going to be on Maximum's Hot 100 next year, but she is the perfect example of confidence being sexy. Because she is, by all accounts, not your typical beauty. But something about her confidence, the way she does stuff, it makes it all the more better. Anna Kendrick doesn't need the confidence, but she still has it, and she's so super hot.
Yeah.
Brittany Snow, I've been in love with since John Tucker Must Die. So
I got a new almost favorite now, Alexis Knapp. I did not know anything about her really until this movie. She plays the girl who's the kind of promiscuous girl. She is amazing, amazing looking, and she's funny in this movie as well. All the characters, all the members of the Bardem Bellows have their own little quirks. The Anna Camp character, who's like the leader, she's sort of domineering. She doesn't let any of the girls mess with any of the troublemakers, otherwise they get kicked out. Rebel Wilson, her character, Fat Amy, she makes fun of herself so nobody else does, and she's sort of outlandish and rambunctious. There's the gay chick, and Alexis Knapp's character is a slut, and then there's this Asian girl who speaks like she's like a church mouse, as quiet as a church mouse, but she says the most horrific things at the oddest times, and it's just too funny.
You lost me there for a minute just because I was looking up Alexis Knapp on IMDb because the name is so familiar to me. I almost could have sworn she was in something I saw years ago. But and listeners at home, let's be interactive. Go to IMDb, look up Alexis Knapp, and click on the pictures.
Knapp.
There is a picture of her. It's a red background. She's got black hair. Her eyes are piercing. I'm pretty sure I just fell in love with my computer screen. I'm not going to be able to function for the rest of the show. Wow.
She was in Project X not too long ago, folks. So you remember her from that for sure. But she's the shit.
And that's how we derail our show.
Yeah, and she used to mess with Ryan Phillippe. So.
Oh.
Lucky him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
think she's pregnant too. So I don't know. So anyway, I know it's running. But I think it's Phillippe's kid too.
Oh God, he's gonna have anyway. Justin Timberlake hair from NSYNC days. It's gonna come out with frosted tips.
Yeah. Anyway, this movie has a lot, as you expect, it has a lot of music in it, a lot of singing. Anna Kendrick has always had a great voice. Anybody who saw Todd Graff's musical Camp, if you heard her bust out Ladies Who Lunch, yeah, she can sing her ass off, and she does it here as well. The music is fun. I think I got a little sick of it after a while. The mashup started to get on your nerves. You can only hear so much Bruno Mars before you're ready to choke somebody.
Especially when they make the good music. That kid.
By the end of it, I was like, yeah, I'm about music down here. But but otherwise, once you get over that, this movie's just kind of cheerful and bouncy, and you know, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Ellen Page's movie Whip It, which was just it's kind of a fun girl power flick. It's not meant to be memorable. It's just fun and kind of inspirational, and that's all it is. So I had fun with it. I gave it 3.5 out of 5. Anna Kendrick. It's been a good month for her, but she's great in End of Watch also. And this too. So she's curly looking up here. So I say go out and have fun with Pitch Perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a good enough date movie. Any guys out there, you shouldn't be scared of it. It does have the whitest white girl version of Blackstreet's No Diggity I've ever seen in my life.
Absolutely. It's so white.
No Diggity, no doubt.
Anna Kendrick is as white as white can get.
Oh, yeah. I mean, geez, we're talking milk toast here, people. I'm looking back now at her filmography just to see where the misstep was, because she must have had one. And I don't, other than her first two, well, Camp, you said was good, and then Rocket Science I never heard of. But everything else she's
remember
done.
Remember Rocket Science? Yeah, I remember that one.
But everything she's done is pretty much a hit. So or at least a hit, you know, as far as her career is concerned. Pitch Perfect is. I would say we're waiting for the movies, but if your girl wants to go out and she's not into Looper, this isn't going to kill you guys. So check it out, and if nothing else, you'll have a lot of people to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's three. I think we reviewed the three best movies of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to go see something new, then go see those. The Master is expanding this week, so I say go check that out. In fact, Paul Thomas Anderson released a new final trailer this week in order to thank everybody for The Master's early success. But it is expanding into more theaters this week, so I say check that out too. You got a lot to choose from. There's some shit out there, but there's far more good stuff out there than there is shit. So you should have no problem finding things to watch at the movies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just looking at the box office, which we'll jump into now, I'm kind of surprised by the number one movie. Hotel Transylvania knocking it out with $43 million.
Yeah.
And when you look at our last couple of weeks, that's pretty significant.
It is. This is the big bounce back week and a huge week for Sony. Hotel Transylvania is a Sony movie, and so is Looper. So Hotel Transylvania opened at $43 million, which is the biggest opening for a September debut ever. That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah, so Hotel Transylvania, obviously a huge hit. Did you see it?
No.
Okay, I saw it, and I just thought it was, like I said earlier, a throwaway film. I didn't laugh very much. I'm not quite sure who it's for. Obviously, the jokes are for kids, very much for kids. There's not an adult joke in there. But the message is for adults. So I was like, I don't know who you're aiming at here. So
That's what we call a misfire.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, all the jokes are really kiddie jokes. It's mostly visual sight gags. But the message is really for adults and, letting your kids expand and be free. You know, that's like the only message this movie's trying to impart. It's like kids are like, whatever to that. So,
yeah. Really?
Number two is Looper, which we just finished talking about. Opened at $21.2 million. Already it's Rian Johnson's biggest hit. Right off the bat, neither Brick nor the Brothers Bloom did much. I did my part. I saw the Brothers Bloom 5 times in movie theater, I think. But yeah, I saw it 5 times. So I did my part, but it didn't make any money. But
that movie is oddly rewatchable, though.
Oh, it's a fantastic film still. Yeah. And that movie, more so than anything for the Brothers Bloom, I thought it had the potential to be really self-important.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like all Rian Johnson's movies are like just on the verge of being too self-important, and and they just never quite reach that level,
right?
Sometimes they could almost be a little too artsy, like if he was left totally to his own devices, but
Brothers Bloom definitely tread on those lines very closely, but it did it in a way that it almost makes you want to see more arty stuff afterwards because it doesn't take you over to the other side. Got to be his widest release by at least 2,000 theaters.
Yeah, definitely. The movie's doing well. It's not all just Gordon Levitt and Bruce Willis, at least not in my opinion. And the reason why I say that is because Joseph Gordon-Levitt, both of these guys, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis, are coming off movies where they starred in that tanked, Premium Rush and The Cold Light of Day. So just having them in a movie doesn't guarantee success. A lot of it is marketing and the fact that the movie just looks interesting. So a lot of that goes to Rian Johnson also.
Indeed.
Number three is End of Watch, which I think we predicted would be the best out of the three second week movies. And it certainly is. $8 million this week, $26.1 million total after 2 weeks. I think it's doing well enough that we could possibly hear some Oscar rumbling. I don't know. It may be a little early, but I think we could possibly hear some because people seem to really love it.
It's like we were saying last week, Michael Pena, it knocks it out of the park in here. So, I would be surprised if I didn't hear rumblings. I'm not saying he's going to get a nomination, but if his name is not in the same sentence as some other people, I would be surprised.
Number four is Trouble with the Curve. $7.5 million this week. It's up to 23.7. Number five is House at the End of the Street. $7.15 million this week. It's at $22 million. Number six is Pitch Perfect, opening at $5.2 million. It's still in limited release. It only opened at 335 theaters this week. And the fact that it had the highest per site average of the week at 15,000.
Wow.
So, yeah, so obviously they've done a great job marketing Pitch Perfect. They've really gone to the hilt with social networking and social marketing for Pitch Perfect. And obviously it's doing a great job, obviously. So it'll go wide next week, and we'll see what it does then. But that's obviously a great start. Number seven is Finding Nemo 3D. It's at $36.5 million now. Number eight is Resident Evil Retribution at $38.7 million. Ignore it. Just look at the foreign gross. Number nine is The Master, which is at $9.6 million. And number 10 is Won't Back Down at $2.7 million. I don't even want to talk about it. $2.7
million. I got to talk about number 11 real quick just because I haven't been this disappointed since Punisher Warzone came out. Dread was a movie I think both of us liked quite a bit. And it has severely. I mean, I'm not talking John Carter tanked, but it's severely tanked. It's dropped off of the top 10, and it's only made $10 million of its $50 million budget back. So we won't be seeing Dread 2. This will be relegated to DVD cult hit.
Yeah, I think that's what we kind of figured it would end up being last week. Yeah. It was not going to.
Poor Carl Urban. I feel like he's going to keep getting screwed over.
Yeah, it's got $10 million on the foreign market right now, so it's at $20.9 million overall. I don't remember how much this cost. I think the budget was somewhere around $40 to $50 million, if I remember right. So,
yeah, $50 million is what I got.
Okay, $50 million. Yeah. So I don't know. Let's see what it does in the foreign market. $10 million. I think it's only open this week internationally, so it could possibly make up that difference. But domestically, yeah, it's not going to do anything. And it was, I think it was hard. We were never really thought it was going to. An R-rated action film on a comic book character most people don't know or care about. It was always going to be tough. And a tough sell.
Yeah, well, let's at least hope it gets its cred in the DVD market or Blu-ray market or video on demand, whatever the hell it's going to be about when it comes out. The other movie we talked about today, Person Being a Wallflower, is the second highest per site average with $11,000 per theater, $1.1 million on 102 screens. So that's pretty damn good. It's got $1.4 million total. So that'll I'm sure, be getting a wider release as the weeks roll on.
Yep. Doesn't come out wide, I think, for another 2 weeks. So we still got a little while for that one. But I hope it does well. It certainly deserves to.
No doubt.
Yeah.
DVD market here. We got some stuff out this week. It's not as big a week as it was last week, but we do have some stuff. Of course, now my screen's freezing. That's why I'm padding for time here. But Dark Shadows.
Yep.
The Johnny Depp remake of not really a remake because it's completely different of the old TV show that nobody liked comes out. Cinderella trilogy comes out. I didn't know there were two Cinderella. I didn't know there were more than one Cinderella movie.
Yeah. Going back to Dark Shadows for a second. I find it interesting, and I comment on this somewhere. Maybe it's when I think a clip of Frank and Weenie came out earlier this week, and I may have wrote it there. But it's funny how quickly things change. Dark Shadows came out back in May.
Right.
And it was, while it had a lot of buzz surrounding it, it didn't really do a whole lot box office-wise.
Yeah.
And I think we were all commenting on just kind of getting sick of Tim Burton at this point.
Yeah.
And it's not that he's bad. It's just that he keeps making these remakes and adaptations and all these things that limit his creativity. He needs to be doing his own stuff again. And then here comes Frankenweenie right around the corner now. And Frankenweenie is probably the best thing I've ever seen of Tim Burton, with the exception of my favorite, Big Fish. But I love Frankenweenie, and I can't wait to talk about it next week, although obviously I don't need to anymore, so I already told you how much I love it. But I think it's the most original. Well, it's definitely the most original thing he's done, based on his own short story from like 1985. But Frankenweenie is the kind of thing he needs to be doing more of, mm-hmm. and all the time. No more remakes and adaptations. Just do your own thing, man.
Yeah, especially because it's kind of surprising when you think about the fact that he is probably one of, if not the most unique filmmaker of the last 30 years. For somebody that his stamp is that he's unique to do stuff that's other people's stuff, it's not going to, a recipe that's going to work. Even all the way back to Sleepy Hollow, which I thought was pretty good, but he's doing somebody else's story. Frankenweenie, from what I've seen, I'm seeing it this week, but it just looks awesome. Like every bit of 50 sci-fi giant Ant-Man movies that I love so much, and it's really, you can tell it's something that he wrote, and he's got his formula and his script and his everything meshing together, and hopefully I like it as much as you did.
Yeah. Iron Sky comes out this week.
Yes, I had that marked down.
Iron Sky is the movie about the Nazis from space.
The Nazis on the moon.
Nazis on the moon.
With Udo Kier.
Udo Kier.
People that you do not know his name, but you do know his face.
You know his freaking face. He's in every Lars von Trier movie.
Yeah.
So
do you want to see this movie?
Do I want to see Iron Sky?
Yeah.
I want to see it. I don't want to buy it.
Yeah. Dude, I've been wrestling myself since, because it's been on video on demand for quite a bit. And I every time I see it on there, I'm like, I want to rent it. I want to rent it. And then, you know, the angel and the devil on my shoulder start fighting, and they're like, well, what are you going to rent this stupid movie for? I just have a feeling it's going to be cheesy greatness, and I really want to check it out. But it could just be cheesy crap.
Yeah, but, I think it might be cheesy crap, honestly. Yeah. I don't think it looks very good. It just looks like it could possibly be funny.
Yeah.
But you know what I watched a lot of the other day? Blubberella. I watch a lot of Blubberella, which, you know, I remember when I put up the trailer a couple years ago, I was like, this looks like the worst piece of shit ever made.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of terrible funny.
Oh, really?
Like, I laughed a lot more at it than I should have. And there are some aspects of it that are kind of clever. I'm not going to lie. They're kind of clever. But, you know, so maybe I should stop judging all these really bad-looking movies by their cover.
We will always do that. I wouldn't even try to fight that. Like I said, Cinderella's got three movies coming out. Apparently they made sequels to that. The one I'm really excited about, and I'm probably one of about 2% of people, is that Universal is releasing their Classic Monsters Essential Collection, which we're talking Dracula, the Mummy, Creature from Black Lagoon, Frankenstein, Phantom of the Opera, Invisible Man, Wolfman, Bride of Frankenstein, all the Universal Classic Monsters, and it's in a box set. For if you get it right now from punchdrunkcritics.com, click on Shop Punch Drunk Critics in the upper right hand corner, you can get it for 30% off at a total of $110 for all of these amazing staples of the horror genre.
Mm-hmm.
So,
People Like Us comes out this week. This is the dramedy with Chris Pine and Elizabeth Banks. It wasn't that bad. It was actually okay. I love the relationship between Chris Pine and the kid. I can't remember his name. Kind of reminded me of About a Boy from about a decade ago. But, you know, it's okay. It gets a little overwrought and I think way too overdramatic towards the end. But they laid on really thick at the end of the movie. So, I mean, it's a solid film. One of the better Chris Pine movies. I still haven't seen that movie that I really loved him in. Star Trek. Star Trek doesn't count. Star Trek doesn't count because anybody could have filled that role to me. I mean, that movie was great with that, regardless of him. I need to see him in a movie that's Chris Pine.
He elevates.
Right. I need to see a movie that's uniquely Chris Pine. You know, like, this is his movie. He takes it over. I haven't seen that movie yet. I think he's one of the most boring actors out there. So,
yeah, he is very
solid in this.
He is very right from the Abercrombie model collection. Right. Almost, if he didn't get Star Trek or didn't know somebody, you could almost see him starring in CW series for the next 10 years. But I think he's got a little something that everybody else doesn't have. Sure. Red Lights, which is a Robert De Niro movie. I don't remember hearing anything about this. Sigourney Weaver.
Was a huge hit out of Sundance this year. One of the big sells out of Sundance. Robert De Niro, Sigourney Weaver, Cillian Murphy, and Elizabeth Olsen. I was surprised this movie didn't get more of a release considering the buzz it had. And the generally good reviews. So I'm really surprised by that. I wish I could have seen it back then, but I'm definitely going to rent it now at the very least. So.
You know, this is the habit I gotta break, because I'm still of the old school mindset that straight to DVD equals crap, and it's just not the case anymore. So
it's so much more that goes into it now. It's far more about what goes on back behind the scenes than anything else. Sometimes it's just studio can't get their shit together, you know. And there are so many movies that come out now. I mean, we're talking, if you look at the breakdown of movies that come out every week, it's far more than the handful that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally like a dozen or two, like, per week that come out. And sometimes there's just no room for a movie to come out. There's just no good time for it to. And sometimes the most logical thing for a movie to do is come out in DVD, come out in VOD, and that's what happens to a lot of these festival movies that tend to be really big hits earlier in the year, and they get sold. And then they just can't find a place to release them at, you know, and that's kind of what happened to Red Lights. I mean, it did get a release. It was just really small, really minor. So,
I just went and looked up the synopsis, and it's kind of right up my alley. Now I'm kicking myself in the face for making fun of it a second ago. And Rodrigo Cortez, who did Buried, is directing it. Uh-huh. And I thought Buried was a very underrated flick. But also speaking of amazing movies, Masters of the Universe is coming out on Blu-ray.
It's not amazing.
That's the Dolph Lundgren He-Man movie from the late 80s, giving us Courtney Cox's first foray into the silver screen. Horrible movie. It doesn't even have half the, you know, Orko's not there, and so there's a little midget guy, and there's all kinds of weird stuff. It's not really He-Man, but you might have some nostalgia. You should buy it, and you should buy it from PunisherOnCritics.com.
Absolutely.
There's another version of Princess. Even I'm getting tired of these Princess Bride versions. They're releasing more versions than Star Wars.
Yep.
20th anniversary of that's coming out.
Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding. The Jane Fonda, another Elizabeth Olsen movie. She had a busy year, Elizabeth Olsen. Not all of the movies she's done are good. She certainly hasn't lived up to the Marcy May promise. At least not since she hasn't, not since then. That Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding was largely forgotten after it came out. Not 42 months ago. A Criterion Collection of The Mood for Love. This is Wong Kar-wai's classic from 2000. Go see it if you can. The Hole comes out on DVD. And I think it just came to theaters this week. I think it's one of those same time releases. The Hole is directed by Joe Dante, who did both Gremlins movies.
Mm-hmm.
This is his first movie in years. This is getting really mixed reviews, to say the least. We have the trailer on the site. We just put it up a couple weeks ago, so I don't know about that one, but I do want to see it just because it's him.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Has Joe Dante really done anything since the Gremlins movies?
That's what I was trying to think. And it's been a few years, but I don't know if he's done anything lately other than that. I think he's been mostly doing TV.
Really?
His last feature film was Looney Tunes Back in Action, 2000.
So. You know something funny? I actually watched that this morning because my niece and nephew were at the house.
All I remember is Jenna Elfman was in it.
Yes.
Double Impact is out on Blu-ray. Now I'm going to buy that.
Wait, what is?
Double Impact? Double Impact on Blu-ray.
Nice.
And this is nice cover, too.
I was really hoping that when Expendables 2 came out and Van Damme got the credit that he so much deserves with that, I was hoping they'd start releasing all their movies on Blu-ray. Like as OCD as I am about Blu-rays, I don't like buying the double feature ones if it's something that I want to have like collection of. And they only ever released his like in a double collection with some random, you know, like American Five. And Double Impact is one of the ones that
It's like Bloodsport and Kickboxer 4.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, not Bloodsport and Kickboxer. Bloodsport and Kickboxer 4 with Sasha, with the kid from Step by Step.
Yeah.
So that's awesome.
The Lady comes out on DVD and Blu-ray. Now, The Lady was Luc Besson's attempt at an Oscar this past year, and nobody fell for it, apparently. Michelle Yeoh stars in it. It's a political thriller. I can't remember the lady's name. It's a Chinese political activist. I just don't know her name, and I've just kind of forgotten it. I think it's Sing Kai. But, yeah. The Lady is out on DVD and Blu-ray. I wish I could have seen it. It never got a release here, which I'm really sad about, because I love Luc Besson. And like, this was his stab at an Oscar. I mean, the guy usually makes Hitman movies and, you know, sci-fi movies. But this was him trying to go a little bit deeper, and it was largely ignored. But I want to check it out, because I love Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah, we haven't really seen much, right? What's up?
Sound of My Voice comes out on DVD this week. That's a buy. That's a definite buy. This is the movie by Britt Marling, her follow-up to Another Earth. Sound of My Voice is really creepy, really kind of atmospheric thriller about two reporters who investigate this cult. And Britt Marling plays the woman who's at the head of the cult. And it's a fantastically atmospheric film. And to me, it's a must-buy. I'm actually clicking on it now to purchase it. Well, actually, no, I'm actually not clicking on to purchase it, because I see that's $30 for the Blu-ray. I'm going to go look high and see if I can just buy the plain old DVD for a little bit less. But yeah. Definitely, Sound of My Voice is a must-purchase, if you ask me. And the DVD is $25. The DVD is $25. God damn. The bad thing about these smaller movies that are recognizable, people want to own them. They know they can charge a shit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like supply and demand without the supply being there. You know, they just know the demand's there, so they jack up the prices. But cult movies are like one of those, not like cult classic type movies, but movies involving a cult have always been one of those little like niches that always drag me in. Like it doesn't even have to be like Marcy May Marlene. Like anything that involves like the cult mentality or a cult being there, it always just fascinates me. So I'll have to check that out as well.
Well, we speak to the director and Britt Marling for the movie. Mm-hmm. I think the interview is probably up on the site or on our Punch Drunk Critics Live archive. But they had a lot to say about it too. I mean, this is just one of those movies that I feel like it's going to get forgotten about. It probably already has been, but by people. But it's just—I think it's a movie that everybody needs to see if you're into really, really shocking and intoxicating thrillers. So check it out.
Hey, have you seen Solomon Kane yet?
Nope, still haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either. There's no help to you guys listening out there. I just I really want to know. if it's good or not, because I keep going around it, and something tells me it's good, but then the other part of me is like, well, it wouldn't have been this out this long and available without anybody talking about it otherwise. Anyway,
right.
Netflix Instant Watch. It looks like Rian Johnson is getting his due after Looper. People are finally looking into him a little bit more because Brick is at the top of the of the Netflix recently queued list. Headhunters, Machine Gun Preacher, Tomorrow When the War Begins, The Roast of Roseanne. I don't know why I even mentioned that one. And let's see, The Tall Man, the movie. If you guys always got to check Netflix first if you're going to rent something on video on demand. The Tall Man is a Jessica Biel movie it's actually watch it now while it's in theaters. You'll pay $9 through Comcast. Netflix has it instant right now. Clown, also available instant. Mansum, The Dead Undead, and The Gray is probably your best choice on there right now. So,
all right,
that is that. And in the news world, a couple things I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
Do you want me to jump right into that? Or
yeah, go ahead.
The one thing I really want to say is because I've been really marveling, pardon the pun, that they're going to be using Ant-Man in a movie. And then this video came out this week of they showed a trailer during Comic-Con in a closed room. Mm-hmm. And one of the people in there was an animation artist and redrew the whole thing basically by memory. What did you think of the Take On Me, Aha, pencil-drawn trailer for Ant-Man?
It's as someone who did see that trailer in Comic-Con, it's actually a really nice recreation of it. It looks it's pretty much dead on what happens in the trailer. But the only thing you can't really, obviously you can't tell, is the look of the suit And, you know, you don't really get a sense of how smooth he transforms from big to small, which he does quite a bit during that scene.
That was my main question. Because watching the video, you see he gets a little the jitter to show he's getting bigger and smaller. But, you know, I haven't really ever read too much into Ant-Man, but I always just thought he got smaller and did his job or got bigger. But he actually uses it as a tool. Like, you know, he's bigger and then he shrinks down and really quick like that. How did it look on in the actual screen?
It looks amazing. Like I said, it's really fast. It moves really smoothly. Like I said, you could see his transformation just happens kind of really seamlessly. So I mean, I thought it looked great, and the artist's recreation of it is a really nice representation of it, I think.
I cannot wait to see what Robert Downey Jr. does with Ant-Man as far as back and forth, because that's going to be probably the best part about having Ant-Man in it.
I'm curious to see who they cast as Ant-Man. I mean, we still don't know anything about that movie hardly, except that Edgar Wright is doing it, and that it's going to be based in part on the To Steal an Ant-Man. I think is the issue, or To Catch an Ant-Man. I can't remember the name of the title, but that's all we really know about it. I mean, we assume that it'll start filming next year and it'll come out in 2014, but we really don't know anything else. So
was it just a visual stuff?
It was just a stock person. It was just a random dude.
Okay.
It was just some stunt guy.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah, it was just some stunt guy.
Same
it was just to give us a feel for how he was going to be doing the movie. That was all. And if that's the case, then it's going to be a pretty hyper-kinetic type movie, which is a good thing. So
I think this is a character kind of like Tony Stark that could be very deep and could possibly bring an actor that we've maybe written off or forgotten about a new life in this. Because, I mean, Hank Pym is probably one of the most complicated heroes as far as, like, psyche goes in the Marvel Universe, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they'll ignore a lot of the really bad things about Hank Pym.
No wife beating.
I'm sure they'll probably stick with him creating Ultron and him creating like the Avengers' worst enemy ever, but the wife beating part, I'm sure they'll find a way to leave that out. They might still make his relationship with the Wasp very complicated, but the wife beating kind of makes it hard to root for him.
Yeah, I mean, they could even just make it like he yells at her a lot or something. They don't have to go that far. I mean, and honestly, I think for a movie's purposes, his Napoleon complex should be enough. The fact that his powers are shrink down very tiny and, you know, everything that comes with that. Sticking with superheroes, Spider-Man 2 is now a go with Andrew Garfield in the tights once more. What do we think we're looking at for Spider-Man 2? I mean, are we going to get Goblin back? What are we thinking?
I don't know. I'm honestly, I don't know what they're planning at this point. And I think that's kind of exciting that I don't have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they brought in the guys who wrote Transformers, Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman. They brought them back, like, I think in April. They hired them to write the sequel. The only question that was really there was whether or not Mark Webb would come back to direct it. There have been a few issues with the filming of this one, and basically one of the main reasons why Sony went in the direction they did anyway was because Sam Raimi and all those guys are making so much goddamn money. So they really got Mark Webb to film Amazing Spider-Man cheap. You know, he's pretty inexpensive. He'd only made one movie at that point, which is 500 Days of Summer. So they got him pretty cheap, and, you know, of course he wanted a nice little pay raise for the sequel. And Sony was kind of skittish on that, but it all came through, and they hired him. He's back, and Andrew Garfield's back. Emma Stone is still in talk. She's not confirmed yet, but of course she'll be back. You know, I don't know where this one's going to go. I honestly have no clue. I'm thinking we'll see Venom in some way because they're going to want to build into that franchise that they got starting now with Josh Trank directing it. So I assume we'll see Venom in some way, shape, or form. And I kind of get this feeling that we're not going to see the Green Goblin. I think they're going to try to steer clear of that for a while.
I would like that, honestly. I think that would, you know, the darker tone of, you know, certainly Goblin's a crazy mofo, as it were, and he could do some evil stuff. But I just think, right. as far as looks go, I think the Venom route, and even I still want to see the Venom Carnage storyline. But, you know, I almost forgot this movie came out this summer. and it's funny because I really enjoyed it. I'm buying it the day it comes out. Mm-hmm. And it made almost $700 million. So it's not like it was a flop by any means. But it just seems kind of somewhat forgettable, but my Spider-Man need has went exponentially up ever since I started reading the Civil War Marvel storyline, because I didn't realize he was that important, and you know, the big role he has in playing stuff, and it's I really like Andrew Garfield, especially in this role. So
it's crazy to think that Spider-Man's $750 million is a distant third behind The Dark Knight Rises and The Avengers this summer.
Mm-hmm.
That's how big this summer's been, where $750 million gets you third place.
that's just
insane to think about.
It also shows you how fickle industry people are, because everybody's like, oh my god, the box offices are down so far just because of the last 2 weeks. How quickly they forget.
A couple other things that I had that we don't really need to get into too much. Gina Carano is the first woman to join that female Expendables movie that's coming out. The movie doesn't really have an official title yet, but we're just calling it that female Expendables movie. So she's the first one signed to it, and I think that's fitting, because I think she's the best female action hero out right now. Jay Baruchel confirms there will be a Goon sequel, so I'm sure you'll be happy about that.
I don't know the sequel, but I'll watch it.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes sequel. Rupert Wyatt's out. I wrote that about a month ago. He's out. But the names that are being floated around right now are Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, who did 28 Weeks Later, Matt Reeves, who did Cloverfield and Let Me In, Juan Antonio Bayona, who did The Orphanage, Jay Blakeson, who did The Disappearance of Alice Creed, Jeff Nichols, did Take Shelter, and the long-distance picks, Guillermo del Toro and Scott Cooper. Those guys ain't going to do it, but they're on the wish list. So, interesting names. I certainly am rooting for Matt Reeves. I think he's I don't know if he's the best out of the group, but I think he's the best suited. So,
I tend to agree with that. Yeah, I'm with there. Let's see. What else? Kick-Ass 2 has a bunch of pictures out. If you guys want to see everybody on set, head over to punchdrunkcritics.com and check it out there. We got Jim Carrey, Donald Faison, Kick-Ass himself, Hit Girl, Chloe Grace Moretz. I can't remember Kick-Ass's name all of a sudden.
Aaron Johnson.
There you go. Aaron Johnson. How are you liking those pictures? Does it look like everything's going to gel together the way the first one did?
Yeah, I think it'll be fine. And one of the cool things about Kick-Ass set photos is, because I usually don't like set photos, but there's not going to be any touching up of these photos. I mean, it's not like the RoboCop thing where you know there's going to be a lot of post-production done on it. The Kick-Ass suits are the Kick-Ass suits. They're going to look homemade. They're going to look like they do walking around on the set. So you pretty much know exactly. It is what it is. There's no bullshit about those. So they're fun to look at.
Yeah.
One quick thing. One quick thing that I want to mention, and this is just it's Patrick Stewart at a comic convention was asked if he would come back as Professor Charles Xavier, and he said, I think there's every possibility. And then he goes and he runs down all his names of his co-stars, all his female co-stars, and then he says, yes, I'll be reprising. So that's pretty much a confirmation that he'll be back as Professor Charles Xavier. My question was, in what fucking movie? Does he mean X-Men Origin? I mean, does he mean in The Wolverine, where he show up in that? Or does he mean in X-Men Days of Future Past, which is the X-Men First Class sequel? Mm-hmm. So that was what I was wondering. There's no answer to that yet. But I'm of the mindset that there's a very specific reason that they're doing Days of Future Past for the X-Men First Class sequel. And I think they're setting up something akin to what J.J. Abrams did with Star Trek, which is kind of a soft reboot of the entire thing. And it's really the only way they can fix all the fuck-ups of X-Men The Last Stand. So I think that's what they're doing.
You hear that, Brett Ratner?
I'm speculating. So that's there's no facts behind that anyway. But that's just what I have to say. We're down to our last minute here. So let's talk about what's next week.
Next week for you, we have Frank and Weenie, the movie we were talking about earlier. It's a week of three good movies, actually. Frank and Weenie, Tim Burton's new stop-motion film, Taken 2, Liam Neeson, yep. Back, and VHS, the a great anthology horror reminiscent of Tales from the Dark Side, Tales from the Crypt, things like that back in the day. So we'll be talking about that next week. Make sure to join us then. Do we have anybody on next week?
I don't think we have any interviews next week, so it'll be just a week of reviews for the first time in a month.
Yikes. So you'll just have to listen to us, folks. Sorry. Make sure to check us out every day at PunchDrunkCritics.com. Any DVDs, Blu-rays, any electronics you need, shop at PunchDrunkCritics.com. Click on the link in the upper right-hand corner. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, feel free to email us, PunchDrunkCritics@gmail.com or yahoo.com, and go on Facebook, like our page, just search for Punch Drunk Critics. And last but certainly not least, make sure to sign up for our email list, folks. We're doing a lot of special giveaways, screening giveaways, everything like that. So make sure you go in there, and we will not sell your email. Just put it in there, hit submit, and other than that, I think we're all done. We'll talk to you later.
We're out. Later.
See ya.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.